Welcome to the Lou Catino Show, where we can learn to reimagine our lifestyle.
Dr. Stephen, welcome to the Lou Catino Show, and thank you so much for being part of this. Your posts inspire me, your work inspires me, and a lot of our patients as well. So we thought we should have you on the show to talk about various subjects because I like your journey, chiropractor, and now so much of food and nutrition and science. So let's get straight into your journey. Would love for you to start about what made you get into this, you know, the whole journey of health and from where you started to where you are now. Would love to hear your personal side of the journey, please. Yeah.
Sure. I'll make this brief. So it's been about 27 years of being a licensed provider here in the United States. And, you know, I'll say that my journey started with just a feeling in school that I had a proclivity to understanding science and understanding the sciences and understanding the human body. And it was just a topic that I wanted to explore more in my education, in my secondary education. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because when people decide to become a doctor, that's something they usually will say, right? You know, I'm fascinated by the human body. And to be fascinated by the human body is one thing. But one thing you learn very quickly when you get into the clinical situations, when you move forward in school, and this is where a lot of people do drop out. They don't realize that in that body that they were fascinated with, there's a person. And if you're not good with people, you may not have chosen the right profession, even though you're interested in the body. And it's interesting just because back in those days, I grew up in New York City and Queens, New York in particular. And, you know, when I got into college, I had to pay my way through, and my the job that I had was always in the restaurant business. But I became a bartender fairly young, right at, you know, maybe 18, 19 years old. I started tending bar. And I learned how to communicate with people. I learned how to love people. You know, I learned how to love people that were not, you know, the people immediately around me that I was in relationship with. I learned how to just love talking to people. And being a bartender was a very pivotal part of my life that really shapes who I am today. So I guess to make a long story short, yes, I was fascinated by the human body, but I was also fascinated by the person inside that body. And that always made me good at what I did. And then, you know, my studies really, the reason someone becomes a chiropractor, there are two reasons. One is there's somebody in your family that inspired you to become a chiropractor because they are one, and that wasn't my case. And the other is there was an experience where you really began to understand where health comes from. And health comes from inside out. And that's really the basic premise of the chiropractic profession. And what we learn drives that whole system is the human nervous system, right? The brain and central nervous system. Anything that interferes with your, you know, that central processing computer we call the brain and your body would result in a state of dis-ease. And that could also then result in disease. And because the nervous system was at the center of our understanding of the human body and how it works, I wanted to know more. So right immediately, as soon as I graduated, I got a postgraduate neurology degree, a 3-year postgraduate program through the Carrick Institute back in the late 90s. And when I did that, I really started to make sure that my practice was specialized in more brain-centered or brain-based conditions. So I started in the early 2000s to work with people with brain-based disorders, whether that be, you know, early Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, stroke for the elderly people, as far as developmental disabilities for young children. And then I started to settle as the years went by on sports concussion and really understanding how concussion can result in long-term challenges, in particular immunological challenges. You know, we think of the brain as being this big giant bundle of neurons when really the majority, 10 to 1, 90% of your brain is glial tissue, and that's immune tissue, right? So chronic dysfunction in the brain is an immune system problem. So that, again, the aspect of fascination. I love to learn. So constantly taking my education a little bit further and my clinical practice a little bit further, I started to really rapidly see the metabolic impact of brain-based disorders and vice versa, and how that would. So the unique aspect of my clinical experience and education is combining the structural knowledge that a chiropractor would have, brain-based understanding of how the central nervous system is the master system that controls all the other systems in the body, and then coupling on top of that an understanding of metabolic biochemical health in a way that is reflective of our daily lifestyle. Those three areas of expertise, I believe, is what makes my message unique. You found me on Instagram, and you know, a year ago, I had, you know, just the followers that I migrated over from Facebook. My entire Instagram page was really just about my kids and my son playing soccer and my daughters and, you know, just my family life. And I made a commitment to share what I say every day in practice in these short videos. And I just started doing them. I put out 4 or 5 videos a week, every week, consistently. And organically, over the last 10 months, my Instagram following grew. And I believe it's because of that communication style that makes me unique as a clinician, and also this idea that I love to communicate, I love to talk to people. And therefore, it just resonated with the public, and you guys found me. So here we are.
And that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that journey. Yeah, your content's engaging and it's effective because it makes a lot of sense. And yeah, of course, the style you communicate with absolutely makes a huge difference, you know? So Dr. Steven, I wanted to ask you, you talk a lot about blood chemistry. So how do you use blood chemistry to help your patients? And I know you have patients with metabolic disorders, brain, cognitive, all of that. You know, what's the correlation and how come you focus so much on blood chemistry, lifestyle, metabolic health? Would love to hear about that.
So when it comes to working with patients, every doctor of wisdom that I've ever listened to had the same thing to teach us, and that is, listen to your patients. They'll tell you what's wrong with them. And therefore, taking a great history and understanding who's in front of you is of primary importance. And then, again, going back into the mid to late 90s, even when diagnostics were not as advanced as they are today, the purpose of ordering an expensive test was not just to hopefully find something. The purpose of ordering an expensive test is to confirm what you are thinking, right? To confirm what you may already know. So the clinical history gives you so much. And then, all right, I want to confirm this. Well, extrapolating that into what I do now in the world of that we exist in the functional health world, the functional medicine world, there's not a lot of standard of care that exists in functional medicine. We can't even agree on what functional medicine is. And what I find is that people who are involved in functional medicine come from all kinds of backgrounds. There are radiologists who practice functional medicine, obstetricians, chiropractors, acupuncturists, you name it, they're practicing functional medicine. And what I find is that the human body is incredibly complex. We do have access to more and more diagnostic information at a cheaper and cheaper price. So what's happening is we're ordering tests, lots of tests. You go to a functional medicine doctor, all right, we're gonna have to get this blood panel, that immune panel, we're gonna have to get this stool test, that urine test, this hormone salivary test. And next thing you know, you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars on diagnostic testing. When, again, it's a shotgun approach. Do you really want to order all of these tests and then confuse the situation? Because look, patient comes in, they're really tired and fatigued. They have gas and bloating. They're not digesting their food very well. Sleep is terrible. All right. Well, do I need to do a hormone cortisol test to know that if their sleep has been trashed for the last 6 to 12 months, do I really need to do a cortisol test? Is that going to really inform me of what I'm going to do next? Their cortisol has to be trashed if they don't sleep well. If they have gas, bloating, digestive issues, do I really need to do a stool test? I mean, can I just say they probably have dysbiosis? I mean, is it going to inform me to do something different? And the answer is usually no. I've done all of those tests. I find value in all of those tests. They are of great value, but not the moment the patient walks through the door. The moment the patient walks through the door is to first identify rapport with that patient, get an understanding of their history, get that 85% of the information that kind of clues you into where you need to start, what is the starting point for that patient. And then you do a blood panel. And the blood panel is what I call a comprehensive metabolic wellness panel, something that includes all of the markers that are necessary to know that starting point. There's always more tests to order, but I find that a routine comprehensive wellness panel that would include inflammatory markers and thyroid markers and immune markers and everything we need to know about liver function, kidney function, et cetera, that's a great place to start because there's so much low-hanging fruit. You can start making lifestyle changes right out of the gate with a very inexpensive test. So for example, in 47 of the 50 states, that routine blood test, that comprehensive wellness panel may cost just a couple of $100 if you pay out of pocket. Now, if you have an insurance company here in the US, your insurance company will probably pay $3,000 for that same panel, which is ridiculous. So you can pay a couple of $100, get an incredible amount of information that together with a great history will inform me, what is the metabolic state of that person? Are they insulin resistant? Do they have early signs of fatty liver? Do they have inflammatory markers that are certainly going to inform what we have to do with diet and lifestyle? And then look at some basic nutrients, whether it be vitamin D, vitamin B12, vitamin B9 or folate. There's so much to gather there. Hit that low-hanging fruit. Take 8 to 12 weeks. Make the lifestyle changes that need to occur. And then the other $4,000 or $5,000 worth of diagnostic testing you would have done, those things will improve as well. If their digestion improves, doesn't it make sense that their microbiome would improve? If their sleep improves, doesn't it make sense that their salivary hormone cortisol panel markers would improve? I think so. And I've been doing this for so long. I know it's true because I've done all the tests. I've done the pre and posts. And I just found that gathering all that information, spending all of that money and time and resources. So it's not just money. There's no shortage of people with money to burn who just want to see numbers on a piece of paper and say, all right, I want to know what's wrong with me. Fine, you want to spend the money, go right ahead. But time is also a resource. And people who have a lot of money would pay even more if you could save them time. And that's a big, big deal in our world. So yes, I have patients in my whole career that are, the working man who doesn't have money to burn. And then there's, of course, the very wealthy who just will say, hey, doc, just run it all. And, I say, yeah, but how valuable is your time? Do you really want to waste that kind of time? You want me to sit there for 2 hours and explain to you what each of these tests mean? If you want to do that, fine. And once I bring up time, the person who doesn't care about money really cares about time. And that's a great way to kind of encourage your patients to say, all right, doc, let's get started with the history. Let's get started with the lifestyle change, the blood panel. Let's take care of that low-hanging fruit and decide what we're going to do from there. Now, there are complicated cases, don't get me wrong, where once we've got taken care of the low-hanging fruit, there's the more advanced testing is always there for us.
No, I think that's amazing. I like your approach to simplicity, because too much information sometimes can actually confuse the patient as well as us. So that makes a lot of sense. Doctor, you talk a lot about metabolic health. And sometimes when we ask people randomly, what's your thought, you know, what's your understanding of metabolic health? Most people have a different answer. So if you could break it down for us, what is metabolic health? And what are some of the lifestyles that are causing people to be metabolically sick today or metabolically inflamed?
I believe the definition of metabolic health is how the body utilizes and sources energy. So again, simplicity, right? But simplicity, there's two kinds of simplicity. There's simplicity on the near side of complexity, which is, you know, I don't really understand anything and this sounds right, so that's simple and I'm going to go forward with that. Then there's the complexity. The complexity is what we, you know, we go to school, we read textbooks, where we just get started in practice. We start seeing patients. We don't have experience. We're learning all the different pathways and the neurological and all the neurotransmitters. And you see people even on Instagram, they're talking about really complicated neurobiochemistry and immunology. And it's like, whoa, that's complex. But then when you understand the complexity, when you finally can put it together, then things become a lot simpler again. So simplicity on the far side of complexity is that's the holy grail for the provider. I like to believe that I spend more time there than I used to. And so metabolic health is your ability to source and utilize energy. Mm-hmm. And what happens when that system goes wrong is we become incredibly inefficient in that system. The post that I gave, that I put up today, was just a 45-second post, and it's actually wrong, meaning it's an incomplete statement that I'm making. But I'm talking about how the body uses energy, right? So if your body needs to do something, if I need to walk the dog, simply just walking the dog, it's a low level, let's say zone one type of activity. My body should know that the best source of energy to use is my body fat to feed energy to my muscles, not pulling the sugar out of my liver in the form of glycogen, because my liver can only hold so much glycogen. Glycogen is rocket fuel. It's powerful stuff. If I'm walking my dog and, you know, a grizzly bear shows up and I have to run, I need that glycogen in my liver to allow us to run away, right? Well, when we become metabolically inflexible, when we start to approach prediabetes, and prediabetes is a disease, it's not a pre-disease, then what happens is just walking the dog, you're actually burning glucose. You're breaking down glycogen. You're not really using your body fat. And how do we know that? Well, if I take a diabetic or a pre-diabetic and I measure their lactate is going to be much, much higher than mine. So a diabetic just doing work at their desk could have a lactate above 2. Now, if I'm exercising above 2 millimoles, if I'm exercising and I'm in what's called zone 2, that means my millimoles of lactate are under the number 2. Well, that means I'm not burning sugar. Mm-hmm. I'm burning fat. And I could exercise for an hour at 180 watts with my lactate below the number 2. And that's not impressive, by the way. I'm just a 53-year-old weekend warrior. I'm not an athlete. Tour de France guys can be in zone 2 at 350 watts. And they can be like that for 2 hours before their lactate climbs. Meantime, the diabetic or the obese person or the pre-diabetic sitting at their desk, walking their dog, doing maybe yoga, and their lactate climbs above 2. Well, that's metabolic inflexibility. That's metabolic disease, right? So how we use energy and how we store energy. So how do we store energy? We talked about glycogen in the liver. We can also talk about glycogen in your muscles, right? So your liver can hold about 400 calories of glycogen, which is, again, sugar ready to go when you need it, rocket fuel, powerful. And you can store about 1,200 calories in your muscles, but the difference is your liver can give glucose to all of your organs. The muscles that store glycogen can only, that glycogen is typically only used by the muscles that are storing it. So if my glycogen is in this muscle, I can't take the glycogen from here and send it to my brain. Okay. So with that being said, if I can only store 400 calories of systemic glycogen in my liver, right? Well, then every time my liver starts to run low in glycogen, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to get hungry and I'm going to seek, no matter how fat I am. And by the way, the more body fat you have, the more energy you have. Body fat is energy, right? So glycogen is a sugar molecule and a sugar molecule held together with a water bond. And because of the water, you can only hold so much. But fat is triglycerides, high energy that doesn't require water. And therefore, you can store hundreds of thousands and millions of calories of energy in your body fat. That's your storage. You want to mobilize that storage, right? Because we have an overabundance of stored energy for the most part. That wasn't always the case in human history, but now the majority of the world's population has an abundance of calories. We have an abundance of energy. Most of it is useless. And therefore we're getting fatter and fatter and fatter, metabolically less healthy, and our body is not able to mobilize that fat. And that's what we try to teach our patients to do, to mobilize that energy source, to have that metabolic flexibility. Now, when you break down body fat, you take that triglyceride, you break it down into free fatty acids. Those free fatty acids provide your muscles and your brain with energy. It's a very high energy source, right? 9 calories per gram instead of 4 calories per gram. It's also results in the energy source being ketones. Ketones are anti-inflammatory. Ketones provide a wonderful energy source for your heart and your brain. Ketones utilized by the brain, especially as we get older, results in less inflammation and oxidation in our brain, which means a healthier brain as we get older, right? So again, I could keep on talking and talking and talking, but I believe energy is now from there. If we dysfunction from there for a long enough period of time, we can start to tax our organs. We can tax our liver and start developing fatty liver. And that results in inflammation. Inflammation results in brain fog. It results in pain, chronic pain, arthritis, degenerative joint disease, disc disease. So we could really go in every direction here, right? We can talk about the degeneration of our hearing, of our eyes, of our balance system. We can talk about how muscles atrophy, but it has to start somewhere. And it usually starts with this way in which your body receives energy in the form of food, metabolizes or uses those resources and stores them. And if that is a dysfunctional system from early on in life, and it usually is once your grandmothers start feeding you crack, mm-hmm. Methamphetamine called cookies, that child is playing with fire. It's kind of like feeding someone alcohol, right? So if you take a 12-year-old, you take 100 12-year-olds and just start feeding them whiskey. Here you go, kid. This whiskey is good for you. Well, not all of them are going to become full-blown alcoholics, but some of them will, mm-hmm. right? So you start feeding a kid sugar because they're cute and kids can deal with sugar and still be cute and not be sick. So I want, as a grandparent or a parent, I want my kid to have a smile on their face and be cute. So I give them poison and they're happy with the poison because they can deal with the poison. But now fast forward 25 years later, they're metabolically diseased, right? And it started with this metabolic disorder that started in childhood. So,
yeah. Wow, that's powerful. Thank you for explaining that. So this kind of answers the question that when people fast and they actually start breaking down, you know, triglycerides into fatty acids, that becomes the brain energy. And that's why they feel more energetic in a fasted state.
Yeah.
Wow. So Dr. Stephen, how would you, like, what are your top two or three steps for someone to make a change in their lifestyle right now if they want to metabolically, you know, increase their flexibility and their overall metabolic health? Where do they start?
The best place to start is with knowledge and understanding. Mm-hmm. That I believe is the best place to start. Recognizing there's something wrong that should be fixed. Mm-hmm. And look, standing in front of the mirror naked and saying, I'm not happy with what I see, might work for some people, okay? But that, I don't think, is a high level of knowledge. I think recognizing a couple of things. So, Luke, one of the things you'll see is that's very consistent in my videos is understanding what food is and what is necessary. So we always say there's three kinds of food. There's protein, fat, and carbohydrate. So you have to know what those are. You have to be able to look at something and say, okay, that's mostly protein, that's mostly fat, that's mostly carbohydrate. Like just understanding that. So for example, a classic carbohydrate would be bread, pasta, rice, cakes, cookies, you know, junk food, of course, but you know, fruit, even vegetables, those are all carbohydrates. And then, of course, there's protein, right? There's animal meats, there's eggs, there's even legumes can be considered a protein, even though they have a massive amount of carbohydrate. But understanding that comes first. And then understanding your behavior. You have to ask yourself a question. If you have a problem, chances are you're consuming more than you burn. And this is not an argument for calories, but you have a problem because we live in a world of abundance and we live in a world of sedentary living. And that imbalance results in a metabolic challenge to you. And you say, I got to do something. All right, you got to do something. What is food and what is necessary? Well, the basic breakdown product of fat is fatty acids. Mm-hmm. The basic breakdown product of protein is amino acids. The basic breakdown product of carbohydrates are sugars. There's different types of each. There's 20 different amino acids. There's many different types of sugars. There's different fatty acids. In the world of fatty acids, there are some that are essential. You have to consume them. You cannot make them. Omega-3, omega-6. If you don't consume them, you get sick. For protein, there are 9 essential amino acids. You can't make them. You must eat them. If you don't eat them, you get sick. There are no essential sugars. None. As a matter of fact, sugar is so important to you. Sugar is so incredibly important that we've been created or we evolved to the point where we never have to consume sugar because it's too important to rely on it being available in our environment.
Wow.
You make exactly what you need. So if you are fasting for 90 minutes, 9 hours, 9 days, 9 weeks, I don't care. Any amount of time after 90 minutes, if I take all of your blood and put it into a bucket, that blood will have 1 teaspoon of sugar in all 5 liters. That's very tightly regulated. If you have a half a teaspoon of sugar, you're probably going to a coma. If you have a teaspoon and a half, you're a full-blown diabetic. That's the difference between health when it comes to sugar, a teaspoon. So here in the United States, 80 to 90 milligrams per deciliter is about a teaspoon in your 5 liters of blood. A teaspoon and a half is diabetes. Half a teaspoon is you're in a coma. So when you ingest a chocolate cake that has many, 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 many teaspoons of sugar, your body does backflips to pull that sugar out of the blood, send it to the liver, you know, send it to the, you know, make glycogen, put it in the muscles, send it to the liver, make triglycerides, store it as fat, get rid of it quick. 90 minutes later, we're back to a teaspoon. The only other thing that I can think of that's that well regulated is your body temperature. You know, you wake up in the morning, you're 98.6, you go to the gym, everything is great. But you wake up in the morning and you're 99.6, you're not going to the hospital, but you know there's something wrong. You know you have a low-grade fever. It's just 1 degree, right? So when something is that tightly regulated and is that important, well, you don't necessarily have to consume it. So I do, when people want to restore their metabolic integrity, low carb is the way to go. Again, not that we want to eliminate, you know, we want to be respectful of religions. We want to be respectful of, you know, people's likes, dislikes, beliefs. You know, we don't sit there and say, this is what the human body needs. You must have this, right? But if you're metabolically inflexible and you're coming to me for help, all right, well, we're going low carb for a while for most people, okay? And then we kind of take it from there. So to answer your question in this long diatribe that I'm going on, the first step is understanding that and understanding what your particular needs may be and recognizing that the body can be catabolic and anabolic. Now, people are smart. They can understand these words. They're not medical words. They're English words, right? Catabolic means I'm in a state of breaking down. Anabolic means I'm in a state of building up. You should be breaking down every day. You should be building up every day. When you wake up in the morning, you're catabolic. You're breaking down. Okay, that's okay. It's probably not a good idea to eat, which shifts you into being anabolic, and then go to the gym, which shifts you to being catabolic. You're better off waking up catabolic, going to the gym, catabolic, stay catabolic, go deeper into catabolic. And then after the gym, some time after, you start eating and push yourself into a more anabolic state. And that way you're not doing this every day. You're kind of doing this nice and steady. So fasting will make you catabolic. Eating will make you anabolic. Exercise, post-exercise, you will become anabolic, right? And that's important because eating is an anabolic event. It shifts you into being anabolic, building yourself up. When it comes to fasting, we talk about how, you know, how important your daily fast is, that we just need to extend it back to what it once was for most humans before we were metabolically challenged, right? I mean, now we just have abundance all over the place. It's just, you just reach. Most people here in the United States, they work from home. Is that a kitchen behind you?
No, it's not.
Oh, kitchen. Okay. Well, there's a lot of people who work from home and the kitchen, the refrigerator is in arm's reach and they're working at their computer. And for 8 hours a day, there's a snack here. There's a snack there. And then ask yourself every time you go for a snack, am I having a nutritional event or am I having an emotional event? Because if we make the analogy to a smoker, smokes cigarettes, somebody who smokes cigarettes, then you're never smoking a cigarette for a nutritional event. It's always an emotional event. You need a dopamine hit, right? I need to take a break from my desk. I'm going to have a cigarette and I'm going to have a dopamine hit, a reward, There's a reward in your brain, a chemical called dopamine, in a certain part of your brain. It's not dopamine that's the issue, it's where that dopamine is. And that's what the nicotine provides you. The same is true for an alcoholic. The same is true for any addiction. The same is true for sugar and carbohydrates and fructose. So each time you reach for a snack, just first of all, count how many times you do that. It's probably 15 to 20 times, no different than a cigarette smoker. No different than a cigarette smoker. It's probably 15 to 20 times you put something with calories in your mouth, drink or food. I don't care if it's an almond. And we're not saying that snacking is bad, but recognize that it's a behavior not rooted in nutrition. It's a behavior rooted in, I need a quick reward. I need to take a break from what I'm doing. I need something right now. When you recognize that, you can say, okay, I get it. Maybe I can replace that dopamine hit with something else. So for me, I choose something that's calorie free. And I'm not proud of it, but I drink black coffee. Mm-hmm. If you ask me how many cups of coffee I have a day, I'm going to lie to you. Not because I want to lie, but because I'm going to underestimate, because I don't keep track. I don't finish every cup that I have. But I definitely consume more than I imagine I do. And that's true for cigarette smokers. You ask any smoker, oh yeah, I only have like two or three a day. No, you probably have 15 to 20 a day. The only reason it's become less in recent years is because we made it uncomfortable for people to smoke in their workplace. We made it uncomfortable for people to smoke in their home. So yes, they're smoking less. I get it. But if you left them to their own devices, they're probably going to do it 15 to 20 times a day. That's why there's 20 cigarettes in a pack. The same is true for food. Recognizing that you're making a dopamine hit, you know, that it's a dopamine hit you're looking for, is a great way, because then you can say, all right, what else can I do? So now people who are metabolically inflexible, Luke, they will, you know, eat a satisfying dinner. Right. I'm going to have last night I had a big giant ribeye steak with my friends in Manhattan, and it was too much meat. It was a tomahawk steak. It was too much. It was big. So I left about 20% of it still on the bone because I was full. I was just full. Right. So the waiter comes by, he takes the plate away. And then everybody starts all ordering dessert. Right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's all ordering whatever, cakes, cookies, pastries, ice cream. And I'm staring at it saying, oh my God, not only am I not full, I could inhale everything on that table. Why is that? Why with protein and fat, the steak, I filled up. You give me a chocolate cake and I have plenty of room, right? There's always room for dessert. Because you don't have a regulatory mechanism to turn that off. Protein and fat, which are essential, carbohydrates are not. Protein and fat are essential. You get enough. Enough is enough. Just like water. You can't overdrink water. Yeah. If I'm watching, now, Luke, if I remember correctly, you're in India, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So I don't know if in India, it's like here where people watch football from noon on Sunday to 9 o'clock at night. They sit on their couch for, you know, 9 hours. I don't know if you do that with cricket, but
that would be cricket.
So if that's the case and you crack a bottle of water open and you drink the whole bottle of water, and then as soon as you're done with the water, you crack another one and you drink it. Then you crack it and you do that for 9 hours. No one can do that. Once you have enough water, you're done. You have enough water, right? But the alcoholic will crack a beer and do that until they pass out. Nothing's going to stop them. Even though beer is 96% water, the alcohol has no regulatory mechanism to turn it off. Sugar has no regulatory mechanism to turn it off. Nicotine has no regulatory mechanism to turn it off. Crack cocaine has no regulatory mechanism to turn it off. It's an addiction. Recognize that when you open the refrigerator and stare at it and hope something jumps into your mouth, that you're looking for a dopamine hit in a way that's very similar to what an addict is doing. It's strong language to call someone an addict. If it's true, then you have to behave differently. You can't tell an alcoholic, all right, instead of 5 whiskeys a night, 7 days a week, I want you to have 3 glasses of wine 4 nights a week. That's not going to work. That alcoholic must stop drinking. But yeah. If I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm not, but there are some times where I travel and get together with friends and I'll have 2 or 3 whiskeys and maybe the next day I'll do the same thing. And that's a lot for me. So I might not feel good for the following week. And I'll say, you know what? I'm going to drink less. I'll have a glass of wine when I go out to dinner and it'll be just one. I can do that. I'm not an alcoholic.
Right.
So when it comes to food, if you're not an addict, then moderation works. Go on the Mediterranean diet. No problem. Mediterranean diet is a euphemism for moderation. It's a euphemism because what is the Mediterranean diet? It's just eating food that's not processed. It includes everything that, you know, it includes grains, legumes, you know, it's 40 to 60% carbohydrates in most books. But it's a diet of moderation. If you can do moderation, have at it. It's great for you. You and I know there are people who cannot be moderate with food or with carbohydrates. There's no problem with protein and fat. The only problem is with the carbohydrate and the sugar. So again, this long-winded answer to your question is knowledge, right? Understanding, recognizing yourself, taking a tally. Am I putting something with calories in my mouth 15 times a day? Can I replace it with something? A calorie-free coffee, tea, herbal tea, black tea, green tea? Can I walk the dog? Can I go for a walk with my spouse? So when you eat dinner and you take the steak away and you have that wave of, I need something for dessert, right? Grab the dog, go for a walk, let that experience occur while you're outside of the house, having a time alone for yourself to meditate, a time with your dog or your spouse. And that wave of desire that would have hit you when you were still inside of your home, that would have resulted in you having some dessert, now occurs while you're walking the dog, and that wave will pass. That wave will recede. So then you come back in the house 20 minutes later and you're good. You already had your dopamine hit through another source. You don't have to have that dessert, and we're in a much better situation.
Wow, I like that. Simple, honest, discipline, consistency, distraction. Yeah, I mean, that's amazing because a lot of people, I like your concept on moderation. If you can do it, do it. But if you struggle with it, you've got to put a stop to it. That's great. You know, you spoke about your routine where you do a fasted workout, you know, because I'm assuming from what you said, you wake up in the morning, you work out and you eat later, you move from catabolic to anabolic. You know, I think it works beautifully for most people. A lot of women and a lot of women experts today keep talking about the fact that, and I believe in bio-individuality and unique, it's different for everyone, that it can mess up the hormones. It makes complete metabolic sense that in the catabolic state, work out and then start to build in the anabolic state. What's your advice on fasted workouts for men and women, especially women who may be metabolically challenged, men too, and hormonally challenged as well, like too much estrogen, too little testosterone? What's your take with your experience on this, Dr. Stephen?
I love this conversation, Luke. I'm really, you're speaking my language. So thank you. These are the conversations and the questions that are just, I could quite frankly spend the whole day talking about it because I find it so important and fascinating. So The first thing I want to do is let everyone know that I'm not a woman and I don't know what it is to be one. And that in practice, my entire career, 75% of my practice was female. Mm-hmm. On Instagram, 60% of my followers are male. It's very new to me, this whole thing. So how I communicate, so because I've had an entire career of majority female patients, I understand the concerns. And when it comes to hormonal health and fasting, the real challenge is during ovulation. It's that 3-day period in the middle of the cycle that's most difficult. And if you're practicing, you know, a routine that's, let's say the most common one, I think is 16-8 method, right? So 24 hours in a day divided by 3, 8 hours is for sleep and rest, 8 hours is for work and being productive, 8 hours is to feed yourself. Women report having a difficult time during their cycle with that kind of fasting, and they relate it to their hormonal experience. So it's never a good idea to be so rigid in your routine. Mm-hmm. And it's probably a very good idea for women during that, let's just say 2 days before, 2 days after ovulation, you start there just to kind of experiment and see what works best for you. But to go down to 13 hours mm-hmm. of fasting, right? A lot of the research on fasting started with, studying people who were practicing Ramadan. And I believe the earlier studies were centered around 13 hours. And 13 hours is a good place to start. For some people, it might be 12 hours. I don't know. I can't imagine it being less than 12 hours, because then there's something else wrong. So if on those days you go to 13 hours, and then again, you can have a cleaner diet, you can have a lower carbohydrate diet during those days if you still want to feel the increase in energy you get from fasting and being low carb. That's a good place to start as far as your fasting routine goes. And again, knowing yourself. One of the things, Luke, with my patients is, you know, that first 3 months I work with them is very, very important. They have to learn not only what I'm teaching them, but they have to learn what their body is teaching them. And then 3 months go by, maybe 6 months. After that, I'm like, okay, you know more than I do. You understand your body better than I do. All I could do is give you guardrails and guidelines and get some feedback from your blood tests and continue to advise you, but you know your body. So that's the advice that I would give women who have a hard time from a hormonal standpoint. Now, here in the US, we have no shortage of women having children later in life than we once did. And women are very empowered here in the US to accomplish a lot in their careers as mothers, as business people, as entrepreneurs. And if you go to my gym, there's no shortage of women between the age of 40 and 55 who look absolutely fantastic. And they go to the gym and they're doing 5 or 6 HIIT classes a week. And they just look great. But then you talk to them and you ask them how they feel. They don't feel so good. And their hormones are all over the place. They have no libido. And I believe that's because in the second third of our life, that again, 35 to 65 year old range, we are not paying attention to how what we're doing can impact us because of where we are in our life. So for example, when you're 20 years old, you don't really need as much protein in your diet as you do when you're 40 years old, because so much of your anabolic health is driven by hormones. But when your hormones start to change from a growth standpoint, diet becomes a whole lot more important. how much protein you get, et cetera. Well, with exercise also, these HIIT classes push women into this zone of exercise that is not, so if there's five exercise zones, zone one is, you know, walking the dog, doing yoga. Zone two is long duration, low intensity. Zone three is kind of no man's land. It's like, so zone two, we discussed it before, you're efficiently burning fat at a maximum level, right? Zone three, we shift from fat burning to sugar burning because we can't deliver oxygen fast enough. So therefore we start burning sugar, and that's okay. Zone three is a good place. And then zone four and zone five are more maximal effort, right? So zone four is something you can only do for 6 to 12 minutes. Zone five is something you can only do for like 60 seconds. So those are super high intense. Zone three is not low intense. It's not high intense. It's kind of no man's land. And that's where those HIIT classes are. And they can result when it's out of balance. They zone three exercise, that's 5 days a week without any zone two, without any zone five, can result in a whole lot of inflammation and hormonal dysregulation. Okay. And that's true for men and women. But I tend to go with this idea that in that second and third of our lives, we should be focusing much more on zone two as a base building routine, and then zone four and five to build up high, right? So you need a wide base so you can build up higher. And these are not my ideas. These are ideas I get from others out there who are, you know, again, I everything you hear me saying is not a original thought. Everything you hear me saying is me applying things that I've read and heard and understand from others. But when it comes to applying this exercise knowledge, I would say 80% of my time in the gym is in zone two. Mm-hmm. 80%, you know, up to 4 hours a week, 5 hours a week of zone two. And then I'll do through weightlifting and through assault bike and other things, I'll do my zone four, my zone five. And that is a good balance for somebody. Again, in your first third of life, if you're under 33 years old, well, it doesn't matter what you do. You're going to look great. You can. I love these videos, Luke, of people talking to our community. They're 27 years old, 12-pack abs, and they're talking to people who want to lose weight, who are metabolically trashed, and saying, hey, do what I do. Look at me. It works. Yeah, that's not going to work. It's not going to work. You know, I know firsthand on my body, I'm 53 years old. I've been obese. I've been overweight. I've been pre-diabetic. I've been through all of this. I know what it takes to fix it. And when it comes to exercise, it's super, you know, your primary concern should be don't get hurt, right? Especially when you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s. It takes a long time to heal. You lose muscle too fast. It's hard to gain it back. So don't get hurt is the first rule. Second rule is build a wide base. 80% of my gym time is in zone two so that my zone four and five can get better and better, right? Because yeah. I can't build my zone four and five if I have no base to build it on. And I kind of break up exercise into flexibility, cardiovascular health, strength, and stability. Right? Those are like the four realms. When it comes to men and testosterone, all of the signs and symptoms of low T, of low testosterone, are also the signs and symptoms of high estrogen. Mm-hmm. They're the same. And I know people who are metabolically super fit and they have the testosterone of a 12-year-old girl, and they're fine. And I'm joking when I say 12-year-old girl, but somebody, you know, like myself, 53 years old, I have no complaints of symptoms associated with low testosterone. Yet most people would look at my testosterone numbers and say, oh man, that should be higher. And I'm like, all right, well, why? Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to get from that, right? Do I need to artificially replace it? Maybe. Look, I'm not an endocrinologist. I'm just saying my strength is great. My energy is great. My sleep is great. I have no complaints. And if my testosterone is 450, then so be it. Of course, free testosterone is a different number, and we can talk about that. But when you are metabolically unhealthy, and we can typically measure that in most people with some aspect of insulin resistance, now you're going to take that testosterone and shuttle it into estrogen. And for me, the number here in the US, when we do blood work, my cutoff is 20 for estradiol, for E2. If it goes above 20, that's aromatization, which is an enzymatic process that converts testosterone over to estrogen. And we see people with estrogen, you know, in the high 30s, 40s, 50s, and their testosterone could be low, it could be high, it could be anywhere, it doesn't matter. And here's the big mistake people make. They'll do the test, they won't check the estradiol, they won't check the estrogen. They check the testosterone. Oh, look, my testosterone is 275. It's too low. And they take testosterone replacement therapy. Meantime, they never check their estrogen. It's in the 40s or 50s. What are you going to do with that exogenous testosterone that you're taking? You're going to shuttle into more estrogen, and your problems are going to get worse. And, you know, it becomes this vicious cycle.
Wow. I need a lot of time with you, Dr. Steven, you know, just go on breaking this little conversation into so many things, but yeah, I want to be respectful of your time, doctor. You said you're 53 years old. You don't look 53. I mean, take us through your routine. I'm inspired. You know, what's your routine? How do you, you know, not just your food, you know, how do you manage negativity when you experience that in life? You know, talk to me about your routine, a little bit of that. I'd love to know about, you know, your routine, please. Yeah.
I'm the son of very passionate, emotional Greek immigrants. And you know, the way we deal with stress and life was always, you know, related to food and yelling. So yes, it was a difficult journey to managing a lot of these things. I say difficult. It's not difficult. It's just doing things different, right? Don't use the word difficult. It's different. For anyone looking to make a lifestyle change, it's uncomfortable to do things differently, right? So opening, you know, having great communication with with the people who are important to me in my life, my children, my wife, having those open lines of communication so that we don't bottle things up and seek emotional management through substance, whether it be cigarettes, alcohol, or food. You know, so addressing things emotionally now, not shoving them aside, so that has been a great practice. There's a lot that still is left to be desired. My spiritual health could be far better than it currently is. As I get older, I place a much greater value on spiritual health, and I probably do more than most, but I could always do more. So as far as routine goes, you know, getting for me, this was a topic of conversation in my house. I have teenagers. It's so important to do simple things like you never go to bed without the kitchen being clean. Mm-hmm. You never wake up to a kitchen that's not clean, right? It's just a mind cleansing thing. Leaving things out, not taken care of, is a metaphor. It doesn't have to be the kitchen. You know, it could be anything. So that's a good practice. I try to exercise every day. By trying to exercise 7 days a week, I can effectively 99% of the time do it 5 or 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
But if I shoot for 3 days a week, maybe I'll get it only once or twice a week. You know what I mean? So that's just me. If I overshoot, if I have a more specific target and I miss it a little bit, that's okay. I'm still in a better place, right? Mm-hmm. So I try to make my life as routine as possible most of the time. So I always say Monday through Saturday afternoon is very routine. And that way, Saturday night, when we're much more social with family and friends, I give myself grace to to have the dessert, to have the, you know, the things that Monday, do I have to have dessert every day? No, nobody has to have dessert every day. Like, why is we have to have something sweet every day? Why do we have to have, you know, all of those things that people would consider cheating? And I don't like to use that because it implies that you should have guilt. Well, all of the things that I do enjoy that are, you know, whether it be alcohol or ice cream or what have you, those are all things I cannot find in my house. I have to leave my house to get them, right? I have to leave my house to get them. I could not, I'm telling you right now, Luke, everything that I said today, if there was a gallon of vanilla ice cream in my freezer and I had dinner and I tried to walk there's no way I'm not going to have that ice cream. There's no way. So why even have it in the house, right? So this is, it's not a struggle. It's the luxury of abundance that we have in this world that we just have to manage where we allow ourselves to be in abundance, right? It's good to suffer a little bit. Like when I exercise, man, if I'm not feeling pain of some discomfort, I'm not exercising.
Right.
Yeah. It's okay to be hungry. You're going to eat. It's not like, you know, I have a refrigerator and a pantry full of food. I can go a few hours feeling hungry. It's not painful. It's not debilitating. I'm going to be hungry for the night, but I'm going to reward myself with a satisfying meal when it's time to eat. So I guess to answer your question, my practice is to allow for some degree of suffering. I like to do cold plunges. I like to do saunas. Those are very uncomfortable environments that give you a reward, right? When you step into a cold plunge, it's painful. It's painful. But when you get out, it's a greater dopamine hit than anything else, right? So allow yourself some pain so you can, if you give yourself the stressor or the pain, well, then the other side of it, there's greater contrast and you can enjoy life a whole lot more than if you're just trying to make yourself comfortable all the time.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stephen, this has been amazing. Like I said, I could go on talking to you, but I'm respectful of your time. And hopefully at some other point, we'll get you on our show again to talk more in detail about these subjects. But I'm inspired. Thank you so much for being so generous and honest with all of your information, your own story and everything else. I usually ask a last question, like, you know, what's the message you want to leave with people? But I really think you said it in your own routine about the pain, about discomfort, which like kind of ropes in with discipline, consistency. And I love your message. It's a balance, simplicity, science, experience, and everything together. So thank you so much. I really, really appreciate getting to know you today on this podcast and having all of your information shared with us. And anyone watching this, you need to get over to Dr. Stephen's page. There's a load of the most awesome information and learnings for you to take away from there. Dr. Stephen, if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can get in touch with you?
I would say Instagram, on social media. Dr. Stephen G is my universal handle, DrStevenG. And on there, you'll be able to find websites and other things that I'm doing. But the best way to reach me, I guess, would be on Instagram.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Dr. Stephen. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Luke. It was really a good time. I look forward to coming back.
Thank you. See you soon.
Stay tuned for more. We're going to continue our journey, learning, sharing, and evolving.